Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Religion. I'm your co-host, Hilary Kale. Joseph Webster's book, The Anthropology of Protestantism, takes readers deep into the lives of fishermen in Gamry, a village perched above the sea in northeastern Scotland. It's a place of great wealth and also poverty, a place of staunch Protestantism among many of the older people and reckless abandon or religious unconcern among the young and incomers, that is, new arrivals in the village. By tracing the millennialist faith of the villagers, many Presbyterian and Brethren churches, this careful ethnography calls into question assumptions about the decline of religion in modern societies. It asks, how do the fishermen of Gamry experience life as both modern and enchanted? I'm pleased to welcome Joe Webster to NBIR to discuss this question and many more. Hello and welcome.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good, good. So from the outset of the book, you discuss how in some ways you were an outsider in the context you were studying. How did you come to study Scottish Protestantism and Gamry in particular?
Okay, so I guess with a lot of academics, the way my research project developed was by doing something quite small and then it snowballing from project to project. And suddenly I found myself really focusing on quite a specific topic. So as an undergraduate, I studied sociology and anthropology and did my dissertation in anthropology. And my work there was on a little Protestant community in Lewis on the Outer Hebrides, looking at Sabbath observance, what these very strict Calvinists did and didn't do on a Sunday. And then from that, I became interested in really very conservative Protestantism in Scotland. And my PhD supervisor, Michael Rosie, asked me, have you ever heard of Gardenstown? And I said I hadn't. Gardenstown is the kind of official name of Gamry, the village where I did my research. And he had heard of the village through actually the newspapers, because a story had hit the press. A new church had asked for planning permission to have a new building in the village, and planning permission was refused on the basis that there were already too many churches in the village. So this hit the papers. Michael, my supervisor, picked it up, and I started visiting the village, and really quickly I figured out that this was going to be a fascinating place to do my doctoral work. So from then on in, I began to make plans and wrote a proposal for the work.
So tell us a bit about Gamry. I realized I pronounced it incorrectly before, right? I was saying Gamry. Tell us a bit about Gamry. It's so evocative in the text. Where is it? Who lives there? There are a lot of churches. What are the people's lives like?
Sure. So it is a very intriguing place. It's in the northeast corner of Scotland, about an hour and a half north of Aberdeen. It's dominated by the fishing industry. So it's a village of 700 people with six churches, which is supposedly the highest number of churches per head of population anywhere in Scotland. But because of its very strong fishing industry, it also reputedly has the highest number of millionaires per head of population. So it's famous for its religion and it's famous for its fishing industry. To be a bit more specific, the religion is a millenarian version of Protestantism dominated by the Plymouth Brethren. They're a dispensationalist group that invented the theology of the rapture, where at the end of time, all the Christians will immediately vanish from the face of the earth and an apocalyptic end time scenario will unfold. And then with the fishing industry, it was dominated by big deep sea prawn trawlers. And because For various reasons, the price of prawns went through the roof. So lots of men made huge amounts of money through the fisheries.
So I definitely want to come back to the end times. We haven't reached the end of the end times.
No, indeed.
but I did want to ask you, because you mentioned in the book that there are, of course, a lot of other people who live in Gamry as well. Sure. So who are some of the other people?
Sure. So the population of the village in local imaginings was really divided into locals and incomers. So locals were understood to be those people who had been born and brought up in the village. And incomers were a slightly more diverse group. So incomers could mean people from Scotland who were not from the village, whether that was from a village next door or from Edinburgh or Glasgow or somewhere quite different. And also you had people from England moving into the village. These were referred to as English incomers, and they generally were holiday homeowners. So they would be living in the village for a few months a year, would buy the kind of small traditional fisher cottages at great expense. And they were really there for the natural beauty of the village, for the laid-back, slow lifestyle that they thought they would find there. There were also divisions within the local population, so it wasn't the case that the local Gamry folk were all the same, not at all. So there would be strong divides by age, as you mentioned in the introduction. So young people really didn't have much interest in the churches, older people certainly did. And by virtue of having six churches in the village, there was also a lot of religious diversity. So the local population, the church-going population, was divided six times over: four Brethren churches and two Presbyterian churches. So a lot of variation by religious background, by age, by income, and to a certain extent also by nationality.
Right. And as you note in the book, that although maybe for outsiders, closed Brethren, open Brethren, it all sounds awfully similar. But for them, of course, I mean, these are very different churches. So there's the need to have that many churches, even in such a small space. Each one is doing something slightly different.
Yeah, that's very true. So the history of the religion in the village was essentially the history of schism. So the fact that there were four slightly different types of Brethrenism in a village of 700 people really emerged through various breakaway groups leaving the established Brethren fellowships and setting up their own meeting. The open and closed Brethren distinction is a historical one that still persists today, but there were also splits within both the open and the closed side of the movement. Sometimes people would comment to me that was just as much about personality clashes as it was about doctrinal disagreements. And certainly in terms of doctrine, the Brethren churches and also actually the Presbyterian churches were very similar. They had much more in common theologically than what divided them, I suppose.
So I started by mentioning that in some ways you were an insider to the place that you were studying. In some ways you weren't, of course. What was your life like in the village? How did people respond to you? I mean, here you are, a young guy showing up and wanting to go to church all the time at every church.
Different, yeah. So my status, my identity within the village was ambiguous, to say the least. So I was open about the fact that I'm a practicing Christian, and that gave me a certain level of access, initially at least. It meant that the two Presbyterian churches were willing to consider my request to move into the village and do some research. Although at that time when I was living in Scotland, I was attending a Free Church of Scotland, which wasn't represented within the village. So, you know, some people acknowledged and treated me as if I was a Christian, but others certainly didn't. The way in which someone's faith background is assessed within the brethren would be really quite particular. So there wouldn't be as much sense of a kind of a broader Christian community. They would draw the circle around who was and wasn't deemed to be a Christian in quite specific ways. So that left me in many respects, I think probably more respects than being an outsider, or rather being an insider. It really did leave me as an outsider. I had no background or connection to the brethren at all. And I suppose the other thing was that I, when I moved there, knew absolutely nothing about fishing. So I'd never been at sea. I'd certainly never worked on a trawler. So that status of being someone who had no connection to a life at sea absolutely marked me out as someone very different.
And you talk a bit about how the folks in Gamry really divide their world up into the farmers and the fishermen, right? And the farmers are sort of a problematic, less moral category, perhaps. I don't know where academics fit in that dichotomy, but anyway, probably on the farming side. So one of the things that you describe in Gamry is this triple pinch, as you call it, pressures that are economic, demographic, eschatological as well. So getting back to the end times, in brief, what are those pinches?
So I try and describe in the book the way in which Gardenston was a place that was going through really quite rapid change. So the demographic pinch was something that's going on elsewhere in Scotland and in Northern Europe, which was essentially a process of out-migration. So younger people were leaving the village to find work in bigger towns. But the reason this was particularly painful for Gamry as a place was that meant that local churches and brethren fellowships were rapidly losing the human resources that they previously had. So young people were spending less and less time at church, more and more time at sea. And that's if they were living in the village at all. Many of them moved to Fraserburgh, which was the local large fishing port. And really, their connection to the village was greatly reduced as a result. The economic pinch was connected to that in a sense. As young people moved away, the economic base of the village had become weaker. But there was also a more general sense that the fishing industry was in crisis. So the way in which European Union regulation was putting the local fishing industry under pressure meant that more and more fishing crews were going bankrupt, and those few successful skippers and crews that managed to remain within the industry were becoming more and more wealthy. So what you were seeing was an increasing polarization. Those who were struggling within the fishing industry generally went bankrupt, and those who were doing well generally became extremely wealthy and actually more economically dominant. There was also, I suppose, within the economic pinch, the fact that as people, particularly young, economically active people, moved away, that meant that the support that the churches could expect was going down. So people weren't tithing in the same way that they were in the past. That's more relevant for the Presbyterian churches, but also for the Brethren churches, that the financial support base within Brethren fellowships was going down because young people were moving away. And then the third one that I try and talk about was the eschatological pinch. And I suppose what I try and describe there is the fact that not only was Gamry potentially facing its kind of final days demographically, and not only was the fishing industry facing its final days economically, but local people, local Christians particularly, were very concerned about the fact that they believed that the village and the world was facing its own end, its own kind of apocalyptic end. And this was drawn from their theology of the end times, their dispensationalist view that defined the present as the last of the last days. So time was very short for particularly my elderly Christian informants. They were desperately trying to share their born-again faith with young people within the village and were finding very little success in doing so. And they were anxiously aware from their perspective that because the world was soon to end, as they described it to me, that the day of salvation, the kind of window of time for becoming born again, from their perspective, was rapidly closing. So in a very literal sense, they felt the village to be facing its own apocalyptic end.
Of course, those listeners who work on Christianity and especially dispensationalist Christians, this will all sound awfully familiar. But for those who don't, maybe we can just clarify. So, So one thing that they're concerned about are individuals, including their own kin, younger folks, being saved, so being born again, and therefore on the right side of God, as it were. And the other thing that they're concerned about is this impending apocalyptic end. What does that apocalypse look like? What kinds of signs are they looking for? What sorts of things are showing them that it is indeed the end times?
So one of the key ways in which local people indexed the fact that they were living in the last of the last days was by searching for what they called signs of the times or signs of the end times. And they were looking for little pieces of evidence which to them confirmed biblical prophecy. So they were fascinated by Old Testament and New Testament biblical prophecy. But what they saw in their own lives, in their own present day, was, from their view, a literal fulfillment of these biblical prophecies within their own day and within their own village. So one of the key signs, unsurprisingly, was the health and state of the fishing industry. So they regarded the collapse of the fisheries and particularly the intervention and regulation of the fishing industry by the European Union as a very clear sign of the end times. So they regarded the European Union as the Antichrist, as a kind of demonic political entity that was seeking to hasten the end of the world by attacking the Scottish fishing industry. And without getting into too many of the details, the local imagination here was that the devil was seeking to impose a kind of world-ending global famine upon the planet. And one of the ways that that world-ending famine would occur would be through crushing the fishing industry. Having said that, there were many, many other signs in everyday life that they pointed towards that to them represented the end of the world. So during my field work, there was a political scandal in the British press about members of parliament's expenses. So the political world was very much drawn into this, the fact that politicians were behaving improperly financially from their point of view was an evidence of this. But even more locally, a higher divorce rate, the fact that young people were no longer interested in attending church, the arrival of lots of people into the village who weren't able or willing to live their lives in ways that conformed to moral expectation. All of these things were seen as evidences of the end of the world. And also natural signs. So unusually harsh winters locally was seen as a sign, but so were earthquakes and volcano eruptions and all of the kinds of things that my informants would be reading in the newspapers, as well as circulating among themselves through village gossip. All of these things were seen as material and symbolic signs that the end of the world was soon to occur.
So you've been talking a little bit about the EU. From the EU's perspective, what were they doing in terms of the Scottish fishing industry?
So do you mean did the EU understand itself to be doing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, presumably not acting on behalf of the devil to crush the Scottish fishing industry to cause a worldwide famine leading to the apocalypse. What was the EU What kinds of regulations had they been instituting in the time that you were in the village?
The European Union saw itself as managing fisheries in as sustainable a way as they could, and the regulations were fairly widespread. One of the key regulations was the quota system, so they legislated on how much fish could be landed, and that was also done by species, obviously. So, for instance, the quota on cod was very, very small because cod was a threatened species. But as well as the quota system, there were also new pieces of legislation being introduced, things like the days at sea system, which meant that fishermen could only be at sea for a certain number of days a year. There were also regulations on the mechanics of fishing, so the size of net mesh was a key issue, and net mesh had to be big enough to avoid catching very juvenile species, and this was an attempt to allow fish to reproduce. But possibly most controversially, there was also market intervention, so minimum prices were set for species at market. And if fish at market did not make its minimum price, those fish would be sprayed with red dye and would be marked as withdrawn and would be essentially turned into either pet food or fertilizer. So the management of fisheries was very widespread. I should also mention that one of the unintended consequences of the quota system was that where fishing trawlers caught large quantities of a certain species without having the required license, that catch would need to be dumped back to sea because they didn't have the license to sell it. Now, when fish comes up out of a trawler's net, it's perfectly fresh fish, but it's all dead because the way the fish are compacted into the back of the net means that generally the fish are drowned. So fishermen were in a position where they were dumping huge quantities of fresh, dead, but very valuable fish back into the sea because they didn't have the required license. And they regarded this as a sign, again, that the quota system was really not what it appeared to be. It wasn't about sustainability because they saw this problem of throwbacks as environmentally very unsustainable. But to them, it revealed a kind of darker motive within the European Union.
Right. And this sort of control from above, I guess, is what's really what they're really indexing there, as you said.
Absolutely. Yeah, the sense of being powerless to govern your own industry in the way that you would see fit.
Right. So I wanted to step back to a theoretical question that arises in your text, the concept of belief. So belief is an important, often contested category in the anthropology of religion and also in religious studies. How do you come to define belief over the course of your study?
So it's a really interesting question, and one that I suppose brings the anthropology of religion, as you've already said, into conversation with all sorts of other disciplines, religious studies, theology, history. I try, I suppose, to walk the line between belief as a series of intellectual propositions, belief being things that we say we agree with, versus belief as a kind of lived out practice. So belief is not just what we think in our heads. It's not just those things that we assent to, but it's also the way in which we live our lives. So belief is also about how we catch fish, or the way in which we preach, or how we plead with our grandchildren about their desperate need to come to born again salvation. So belief is just as much an embodied act of doing than it is a kind of a cognitive process of stating that something is true.
That'll sound familiar to listeners also who are aware of the trajectory and anthropology of Christianity, but you do a careful job, and I think it could be useful for other listeners here, you do a careful job at sort of talking about the development of anthropology of Christianity as something that maybe for anthropologists will sound a little odd, an anthropology of Christianity. Christianity is not really a religion that was often on the menu, as it were, for anthropology of religion. Yeah. So how does anthropology of Christianity view some of these issues? How does it develop? What does your book do in terms of that conversation?
Well, I mean, what I try and do is I try and build on some of the work by people like Joel Robbins and Fenella Cannell, who were influential in forming this subdiscipline, the anthropology of Christianity. And part of what those two scholars point out, other people have pointed out as well, is that anthropology has always had a rather awkward relationship with Christianity. And the reason they have that awkward relationship with Christianity as an ethnographic fact is because they have a rather awkward relationship with theology and with the kind of Christian prehistory of anthropology as a discipline. So, you know, to put it rather bluntly, many anthropologists, when the discipline was first getting going about 100 years ago, were deeply kind of connected to and dependent upon missionaries for their access to the field. Not only that, but as well as spending a lot of time with missionaries and having their access provided by missionaries, they saw themselves as anthropologists as undertaking a very different intellectual pursuit. So rather than being involved in the metaphysics of Christian belief, they saw themselves as essentially engaging in a kind of social scientific analysis of culture and society. So anthropology had this rather tense and difficult relationship with Christianity. It saw it at the same time as both rather kind of dull and well-known, right? It was the religion of home, the religion of the West. But at the same time, they saw it as rather threatening because it was not only engaging in theological metaphysics rather than empirical anthropology, but it was a discipline that was kind of deeply indebted to theology, both in terms of its access to the field and actually in terms of many of the kind of philosophical underpinnings of the discipline. So I suppose what the anthropology of Christianity today is trying to do is trying to not only kind of recognize that theological prehistory of anthropology, but it's also trying to kind of sidestep some of that baggage and then to proceed in its own aim, I suppose, of conducting more thoroughly ethnographic studies of this religion, which up until maybe 20 years ago was very much a minority interest within the discipline. So the anthropology of Christianity is really, I think, trying to make up for lost time because of this rather awkward history that it has with theology and Christian missionaries in particular.
I think that this book certainly is a great example of that since, I mean, it really is in some ways a very classic anthropology. It's a village ethnography in certain ways. But looking at a subject that until recently would have been quite taboo within anthropology of religion. So in chapter four, you take up the question about testimony. You're using the example of a fisherman. He's 65 years old, named Alistair, or at least that's the name that you give him.
That's right.
What kinds of forms does testimony take? You've mentioned it a little bit already in our conversation, but it's so important to the people in Gamery. What kinds of forms does it take? How does your reading of these kinds of testimonies build on other work on Protestant testimony and sincere words that's been coming out of anthropology of Christianity?
Testimony is essentially a local word. I mean, it's used obviously in other branches of Christianity globally, but locally what testimony meant was a kind of born-again conversion narrative. So it was the way in which local Christians retold their own story of how they became born again. So what was particularly interesting about Testimony was the way in which these highly emotional performances, weeping, admitting to personal dependence, describing your love for Jesus, the way in which those emotionally charged performances played against and undermined and in some senses contradicted local expectations about what it meant to be a properly masculine fisherman. So the kind of stereotype of a masculine fisherman would be very strong, very independent, very self-controlled. And what I came to realize as I listened to dozens of these testimonies was that local men were developing new ways of expressing their emotions in ways that undermined local expectations about the kind of hyper-masculine fishermen. But then they didn't simply embrace local models of femininity and childlike dependence. Here, being feminine and being childlike was defined by dependence and weakness. Those were the local models. So not only did masculine fishermen embrace those and kind of reinvent them as tropes of kind of real Christian masculinity, but they also described to me the way in which learning those new emotional forms allowed them not only to be a better Christian, but also a better husband and a better father. So these emotional articulations really had profound effects on the way in which men described their home life, but also the kinds of emotions they could express within religious settings.
When you're talking about emotion here, I mean, you really mean it. Alistair is breaking down crying at different points during his testimony that he's describing.
Yeah, and that would be very unusual for an older man to weep in front of a younger man. That would be something that just would not happen in other tropes of social life. So this was quite an unusual, quite a different form of emotional expression. It was notable not only because it happened in front of me as a younger male, but also because these emotional performances would be conducted often at the front of church, in front of maybe 50 or 100 or 150 people. So they were public performances very often, as well as performances that I myself was collecting as an anthropologist. And I suppose when I was writing about this, when I was trying to pick it apart anthropologically, what struck me was the way in which these testimonies, although they felt highly conventional, the way that they were kind of made to measure tropes of born-again conversion that we see certainly in American evangelicalism, although it felt very familiar in that context, I suppose what I try and say in the book is that familiarity, that conventional nature, didn't undermine the fact that these were still very sincere and very personal emotional expression. So I really try and say that the kind of outward form was not indicative of the fact that it was somehow a kind of insincere emotional performance. This certainly wasn't just crocodile tears, if I can put it like that, despite the fact that it was a well-rehearsed local narrative and also a narrative that had all sorts of resonances with global evangelicalism worldwide.
So in that sense, you're building on, and you mentioned this in the text, you're building on, for example, Stromberg's idea of canonical language. Even though the language sounds similar in different contexts, it's nevertheless a very real experience for those who are expressing it. In what other ways were you either surprised or did you find that listening to these testimonies confirmed for you what you'd already been reading in the literature on Protestantism?
Gosh, that's a difficult question. I mean, I suppose what it confirmed was the fact that although communities have all sorts of complex ways of making sense of who they are as individuals, the fact that these tropes were shared, within the community, circulated within churches, really meant that This was the community's way of making sense of who it was as individuals, but also collectively. I mean, the church would never be busier than on a night when testimony was, you know, the key subject of the service. So local people were fascinated by these performances, by these personal testimonies, and it really did shape the way people thought about themselves, the way they thought about their families, and ultimately the way they thought about the entire Christian community.
Mm. One of my favorite chapters, and we really have to get back to the fishing boats. You mentioned them before. One of my favorite chapters in the book is where you talk about going out on these excursions for bonnie prawn, which I cannot say in the proper in the proper North Scotch accent. But anyway, yeah. Maybe I liked it so much because I'm the kind of person who gets nauseous even in proximity to waves, let alone on them. Yep. So I definitely appreciated your recollections of getting your sea legs. So over the course of the journeys, you were also party to sort of a constant round of witnessing. We've been talking about testimony, but there's also this witnessing that you're talking about as Christian and non-Christian sailors encountered each other. What was that like? What was life like at sea for you, for the Christian sailors around you?
Yeah. I mean, so going out to sea for my first time was obviously an unforgettable experience. I was trying to get onto the boats for about a year before I managed to build up relationships in a way that would allow skippers to trust me enough to let them to let me on board. So that was a bit of a milestone for the field work. I went to sea for two different trips during my last winter in the field. And I suppose it gave me a completely new insight about what it meant to live in this community, because I previously had only seen the community at religion on land. And now I was seeing the community at sea. So the two boats I went out on were both run by Christian skippers. One was a Brethren man, one was a local Presbyterian man. And I went on these boats specifically because of that reason. So they organized their working week in quite an unusual way. They would only be at sea for 6 days at a time to ensure that they were on board, on land on Sunday for church worship. But not only that, but when I was actually on the boats, it was an astonishing experience. I mean, I was taking anti-sickness tablets nonstop and managed to not be sick for the first trip, and then got a bit overconfident the second trip and went to sea on a full stomach against advice, and ended up being violently sick for the first night of the second trip. So there was definitely that embodied experience of learning how to walk again, essentially learning how to walk around the space, not fall over, not bash your limbs off the walls as the boat lurched left and right. And the other kind of very visceral experience was the work. So I was paid as a trainee deckhand and was working alongside the men, obviously much slower than they were, but we worked 100 hours in 6 days. That would be a pretty standard working schedule. So you're fishing around the clock, you're hauling the nets every 4 or 5 hours, and then processing the catch as it comes in. And that kind of labor, standing along a long steel tray, processing the catch for hours and hours on end, was really the experience that defined, for me anyway, being at sea. Because when you were standing along this long steel tray, processing the hundreds of thousands of prawns that had been brought on board, the only thing you could do to pass the time was talk, essentially. And it was that discussion that opened up all sorts of fascinating insights into what it meant to be not only a Christian fisherman, but to be a Christian fisherman working amongst a crew who very often would explicitly say that they were absolutely not born again Christians and had very little time or interest or sympathy for Christian things.
So how did some of those conversations play out?
So one of the key kind of narrative devices that I picked up on endlessly was this process of witness and counter-witness. So Christian fishermen would see it as their duty, as their responsibility to try and talk about spiritual things, to share their faith, not only through testimony by, again, retelling their story of born-again conversion, but also a process where they would directly challenge the non-Christian crew. So they would ask them questions about their moral life, about church attendance, about spiritual beliefs. And it would often feel like a bit of a kind of uncomfortable interrogation. What was interesting was that the so-called unsaved crew, the non-Christian crew, would really push back and would engage in all sorts of what I call counter witness. So they would talk about sexual conquest and drunkenness and bar fights and all of the kind of social and moral and ethical behaviors that they knew would really rile and upset the Christian crew. Not only that, but there would be all sorts of debates about evolution and creationism and abortion and sexuality, and it would just be this kind of endless verbal jousting, the Christians witnessing and the non-Christian crew pushing back with their stories of drunken exploits and all of their kind of counter beliefs about evolution and so on.
Did you see the same sort of verbal jousting? I love that phrase you just used. Did you see the same sort of jousting on land, or was this something that was really prominent at sea?
It's an interesting question. I didn't actually see it very often on land, and I think the reason why it was so obviously present in kind of along the tray when we were working on the boats was that what was going on here was a kind of fairly unique kind of enforced sociality where everyone was working within very, very close quarters. You would be working, 100 hours across only 6 days, seeing the same five or six faces hour after hour. And much of the discussion, both kind of Christian and non-Christian, was often played out in the most extreme terms, often, I think, to try and make the time pass more quickly. So this was something that non-Christian fishermen would admit to me more readily when they were, describing all sorts of behaviors that would make most grown men and women blush. They did so essentially to try and kill time, to try and make the whole experience of being at sea less tedious. But it also clearly then had this kind of added dynamic of being voiced within a situation, within a context where there was a whole other kind of counter series of expectations about, good, clean Christian living. So these two extremes were constantly knocking against each other with fairly profound effects.
We already talked a bit about eschatology, the end of the world. In what ways were Gamerick's mapping that eschatology onto world politics? Talked a little about the EU already. You mentioned in the book Israel. So what kinds of headlines are they scanning? How are they thinking about politics?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing to say is that the Brethren, certainly locally, the dominant trend across all four of the Brethren fellowships was to not vote as a matter of conscience. So they didn't participate in party politics because they saw politics as essentially a kind of demonic realm, very similar to the way in which they thought about the European Union. The flip side of that was the fact that as well as seeing politics as a demonic realm, they were also fascinated by political processes and were very keen to stay as informed as they could about global world politics. And one of the spheres that they were most interested in was Israel, particularly the state of Israel. And this emerged from their commitment to Christian Zionism. And in part, that was because many of my informants were also avid consumers of Christian television, particularly God TV, which was a British broadcaster. But they also were fascinated by North American Christian broadcasting as well. And as a result, local Christians had built up a very strong fascination for the state of Israel, and they would closely watch Israel as another source of signs of the end times. I mean, I remember going to one Christian Zionist convention with a number of key informants, and they were avidly praying for the electoral success of Benjamin Netanyahu. They were praying about the drought in Israel. They were praying about Palestinian land claims and asking God to thwart these land claims as a way of maintaining the integrity of the state of Israel's land borders. So these were kind of live political issues that were being played out all the time. And it was made all the more intriguing because generally my informants were kind of deeply suspicious of and skeptical about party politics. So this fascination with Israel was one way in which they could engage in modern political life, but almost by proxy through prayer, through reading newspapers, through attending these Christian Zionist conferences. The other thing I should probably mention was they were supporting a very interesting fundraising campaign at the time led by God TV. This was a campaign called the Million Trees Campaign, and they were providing money to this campaign in order to plant trees in the Negev desert. And this was pitched by God TV and embraced by my own informants as a way of fulfilling a particular prophecy in Isaiah about making the desert bloom. So they, as well as watching Israeli politics, were kind of practically and financially involved in trying to bring about a kind of change in this eschatological calendar by fulfilling this biblical prophecy that the desert would bloom, and thereby, you know, accelerating the end times and preparing the state of Israel for Jesus's soon return. That's really how they described it to me.
It's a fascinating and really subtle portrait of people who are both outside of politics, I mean, actually abstaining from voting, and yet sure, in other ways deeply immersed in what we would think of as contemporary politics as well. It's a fantastic example of, I think, how difficult it is to generalize about what this kind of faith or belief as it's lived looks like.
Yeah.
So I wanted to end by pulling back to what in some sense is the book's big claim, how we can conceptualize this sort of staunch faith within mm-hmm. the context of modernity. Because,
yes,
of course,
yeah,
you don't want to pull these Scottish fishermen out of their modern context. I mean, they live in the contemporary now. One of the primary ways that you describe it relies on the idea of Eucharistic consubstantiation.
Yes.
Can you walk through what you mean by that?
Yeah, so this is the bit of the book where I suppose I suspect I lose many readers. It gets a little bit dense towards the
Except
end.
Except me. I got very excited by it.
Well, that's very generous of you. Thank
Consubstantiation?
You. That's
fantastic.
Right. Yeah. So what I try and do is I use this term consubstantiation, which is a particular view of the Eucharist, whereby the body and blood of Christ is believed to be materially present, but without changing its outward form. So essentially what consubstantiation does is it tries to, some people, I suppose critics would possibly say it's a bit of a compromise between a purely symbolic view of communion and a Roman Catholic view of transubstantiation. So it basically says that there is a real presence of the body and blood of Christ within the bread and the wine, but its real presence is not such that it changes the kind of outward essence of the entity. So it's both just bread and wine, but also the body and blood of Christ. And what I try and say in the local context is that whilst Brethren and Presbyterian Christians locally would absolutely reject that view of the Eucharist, of communion or breaking bread, as they would put it, because they would absolutely commit to the breaking of bread as a purely symbolic act. What I try and say rather is that consubstantiation describes precisely what they encounter within their understanding of scripture. So they would view scripture as both, a material bound book, a collection of pages, but also the kind of living, inspired breath of God. People would talk about the fact that the Bible is still warm with the breath of God. So they had a very elevated view of the scriptures. Often local Christians would kind of rather playfully, but also in some senses quite seriously, redefine the Trinity as Father, Son, and Holy Bible. So to kind of try and come to the point here, I suppose what I do in the book is I try and say that we can use this view of consubstantiation as a way to read not only their view of scripture, but also their view of all of material life. So to take an example, the nets with which they use to harvest prawns from the sea are not only just kind of material fishing nets, but they are also a demonic index of the end of the world, because net mesh sizing is materially defined by European Union regulation. So we can look at any object, whether it's the Bible, whether it's fishing nets or fishing boats or evidences of drunkenness on the streets, empty beer bottles could be a sign not only of just a bottle lying on the street, but also this real index of demonic attack. The same, interestingly, was the case for divine evidences of providence and God's presence. So there's a story in the book about my landlady having her washing machine broken down and then someone stepping in to provide her with a brand new washing machine, even though they didn't know at the time that she needed one. So the washing machine was both just a washing machine, but also a kind of material sign and index of God's divine providence.
Right. So it's that both and quality that you're tracking there that we can also see in this notion of consubstantiation, right? That bread is both bread and also the body of Christ.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think what that does is it really forces us to rethink how we understand modernity. Because what it really does is it basically says that modernity is not just this kind of full and unequivocal disenchantment that many people, I think, wrongly read into Weber. But what we see is a much more complicated process of what Weber refers to as the old gods rising again within modernity. So things like sexuality and the glory of death in war, and even things like scientific discovery can in some ways reassert themselves. He also talks about the aesthetics of art, that these forms of modern life can reassert themselves as deeply enchanted forms of social life. And yet they crucially exist within the modern world, within modernity. So modernity itself is both this highly rational, technical form of life and governance, but it's also kind of buzzing with the magic of the soonness and nearness, the kind of imminence with an I and imminence with an A, the presence of both God and the devil.
On that note, God and the devil, what are you working on now? Any more fish in your future?
Well, so I am taking a break at the moment from studying the Brethren communities of Northeast Scotland. And for the last 2 years, I have been doing a new piece of ethnography on the Orange Order in Scotland, particularly in the Central Belt. So looking at a different part, looking mostly at Glasgow and a little town called Airdrie. For those who don't know, the Orange Order is a Protestant marching fraternity. It's quite similar in structure to the Freemasons. It would describe itself in some senses as a secret society, but it's also got a rather unsympathetic public image as being highly sectarian. So it is a kind of ultra-Protestant, and some would say a highly anti-Catholic organization. And what the study is trying to do, and I'm currently trying to write this up as a book, is it's trying to make sense of a very, very different version of Protestantism, a version of Protestantism in Scotland that is highly political, that views being a Protestant as deeply wedded to a certain view of Britishness and a certain view of being committed to the kind of political integrity of the United Kingdom. So what's exciting about doing this particular research project at this particular time is, of course, the huge constitutional changes that might well be coming to Scotland with the independence referendum. And as the constitutional arrangement within Britain potentially goes under huge change, the Orange Order as a kind of a unionist, pro-British Protestant fraternity is really trying to grapple with what it means to be a Protestant within their own highly politicized religiosity, which makes Protestantism and Britishness almost indistinguishable.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Joe, for speaking to us today.
Well, thank you, Hilary. I enjoyed the interview.